Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps. I watched a lot of movies this year, and I bet you did too. Some of them were good, some were bad, a few were terrible, but I enjoyed every single one of them. Does that make me a film junkie? One thing is, I'm not alone. Last year, Americans spent more than $11 billion at the box office, and billions more on streaming services. We love the movies so much, we even watch the awards ceremonies, which when you think about it is just kind of weird. We're a nation of film junkies, and today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're going to take that love a little deeper.
Movies puts one into something that I think is closer to the dream state, and I think when you're in that kind of state, you're able to experience parts of yourself that maybe you don't normally think about.
So you can sit in the dark and let a movie wash over you, enjoy the escape from reality. But when the lights go up, it's time to think about what you saw, figure out what you liked, what you didn't, and why. Film critic A.O. Scott does that for a living, and he thinks it matters for all of us that critics play an important role in any culture. He sat down recently to talk with Steve Paulson about his new book, Better Living Through Criticism.
I think we're in a very interesting time for criticism. One of the reasons that I wrote this book and was interested in writing it is there was a lot of stuff being written in 2011, 2012, as I was starting to write this book, about how social media marketing algorithms, user-generated content, reviews on places like Amazon and Yelp, and all of that was going to make professional critics obsolete. What I came to believe was that this was not really about the overthrowing of cultural authority of professional critics, but rather a kind of the coming true or the coming into reality of something that had always really been there, but not as visible, which is criticism as an ongoing public conversation, sometimes between writers like me and their readers, sometimes just among groups of people who are interested in something.
So do you feel like you have a particular responsibility as a movie critic for the New York Times?
I think I have a responsibility to write as well and as clearly as I can and to back my arguments up with as much persuasive information of whatever kind as I can and to not be stupid.
So when critics are at their best, what is it that they do?
I always think of critics as writers. Criticism is a literary craft. It's an intellectual discipline. So when critics are at their best, they're writing well and they're thinking clearly and they're using their own intelligence to illuminate another piece of work. One of my favorite critics and a friend of mine, Alex Ross, who writes classical music criticism at The New Yorker. And when he is writing well about Beethoven or about Wagner, about a performance of piano music that I've maybe never heard of, I feel his intelligence, his knowledge, his wit, his writing ability activating my own curiosity and my own mind and illuminating this work. So I'll go back and hear things in this music that I never heard before, or I may never hear this music, and I will have learned something about music nonetheless from reading his writing about it.
Well, the other question also is, how nasty should critics get? Because clearly some people just take pleasure in writing a scathing review. And I mean, you've certainly done that yourself, but my sense is you don't really do that a whole lot. That's not your thing.
There is pleasure to be found. I mean, I think it is almost the definition of a guilty pleasure. And it can also be a lot of fun because it's often more fun to feel superior to a thing than to feel kind of enthralled to it. And it's easier to feel like you're writing well when you're knocking something down. You can be funnier. You can be scathing. I mean, the resources of invective in writing are quite marvelous. I mean, I try to only do that when I feel like it's really deserved. And I think that negative, scathing, witty, negative reviews can be a bit of a vice. I think that editors often really like them because they kind of get attention and they're funny. Writers can kind of get a little too hooked on the rush and the thrill and the sadistic pleasure. I think it's a lot harder and a lot more valuable to write just as well, just as clearly, and even to be funny or witty in praise of something. And I would say just with movies, there are some movies that I find really obnoxious and demanding of a kind of very harsh sort of punitive treatment.
Well, I mean, you must see a lot of Hollywood crap. And I'm sure you see all kinds of wonderful movies too, but...
Yes. And not only Hollywood crap. I mean, I see, you know, there's indie crap. There's foreign language crap. There's, you know.
But, I mean, it does raise the question of, you know, I mean, what are you supposed to do with a new Transformers movie? I mean, do you even have to review it?
Well, you do, because it's a newspaper, and in a way, the release of a Transformers movie is kind of a news event. So just in a journalistic sense, you have to cover it as you might cover a natural disaster. But I think that even bad movies, sometimes especially bad movies, can be interesting to write about. They can be interesting to write about for the ways that they fail or for even the ways that they seem to succeed. You know, what seems to me a terrible movie can often be a very popular movie. Those Transformers movies make tons and tons of money. And in a way, you can write about that. Well, what is going on here? Why is it that these bizarre, you know, pumped up spectacles about robots from outer space, what is the nature of their appeal? What are they doing? And that's something that criticism can do also, not just offering a kind of thumbs up, thumbs down response, but also kind of going a little deeper and say, well, what does this mean? I mean, if a movie costs $200 million and then, you know, goes on to make $1 billion around the world, that's something that, you know, that you might need to think about and reflect on, and that might mean something.
Yeah. You have a really interesting chapter on the relationship between the critic and the artist. And interesting because there are a lot of people who say that criticism gets in the way of artistic experience. You know, it sort of saps the vitality out of it. And you say just the opposite, that criticism not only enhances art, criticism itself is a form of art.
Yes.
Which might seem a little self-serving, I might add.
It is a little self-serving. And I am inspired in this by a wonderful essay by Oscar Wilde called The Critic as Artist, in which he makes, in typical Oscar Wilde fashion, all kinds of extravagant and contradictory claims about the primacy of criticism as even superior to art. But what I end up saying is that criticism is, first of all, the proper name for the defense of art. It doesn't exist to undermine or to cannibalize or in a parasitic relationship with art, but to support and feed and nurture it. And that, to me, is partly because the impulse, the creative impulse and the critical impulse really exist side by side in us as a species. The same drive that leads us to tell stories, to paint pictures, to make representations of our conditions in the world, that same impulse, or one that is its twin, is the drive to make sense of these things, to figure them out. So criticism is always there, whether it's practiced formally and professionally by people like me. It's always there. It's always part of the life of art.
And one of your points is that artists themselves are basically function as critics a lot of the time. I mean, they are creating art that is in response to previous art.
Exactly, exactly. That criticism is not only alongside art, but is internal to it. So artists look at other work in their own chosen form or in others. They're inspired by it. They're enraged by it. And they want to compete with it. They want to correct it. Sometimes they just want to imitate it. So I think that to me is also a form, and a very powerful and important form of criticism that lives inside of the workings of artistic creation. And that's why, to me, you know, criticism is central to whatever is going on when we're talking about and whether we're making or appreciating and consuming works of art. Criticism is always there, even if critics aren't.
And yet the trap I would think that you could fall into, or that the artist could fall into, is if they're basically always comparing themselves to previous artists, that maybe they should be looking outward to the world, you know, trying to see life in some new and interesting way rather than always referencing another piece of art.
Well, I think that I don't think those things are necessarily opposed. I mean, I think that one thing that you do when you're an artist is you're learning a discipline. You're learning a craft. You're learning how to take your impressions of the world and make them into something else. So I don't think it's just that other art is your subject matter, but it is the context, let's say, that you're working in. And in criticism, it happens that the raw material is other art, which is what makes criticism a kind of a unique and slightly problematic art form. But we are, if we're doing it right, going outside of ourselves and looking at these things out there in the world, that is to say movies or books or paintings or pieces of music, and trying to make something out of our response to them, trying to make something that is original and coherent and that can have some existence of its own in the world. I mean, I don't think that any piece of criticism is necessarily the equal of any work of art, but I do think that criticism is an art form.
A.O. Scott is a chief film critic for the New York Times. He and Steve were talking about his new book, Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. You know, considering all the movies critics see every year, you'd think they'd eventually experience film fatigue, that nothing new could ever be really exciting. But even the most jaded film critics can still be blown away.
This is Manola Dargis. I'm a co-chief film critic for the New York Times. And if you haven't seen Richard Linklater's Boyhood, which is one of the best movies I've seen this year, and perhaps one of the best movies I've seen in my life, I would really urge you to go see it. Boyhood is an amazing film that follows a boy named Mason from ages 6 to 18. Richard Linklater took 12 years to make this movie, and what he did is every year he would shoot for a couple days using the same characters. And Ethan Hawke plays the dad, Patricia Arquette plays the mom, and Eller Coltrane plays the boy Mason. What Linklater did is every year he would convene everyone, and there's a couple years where Ethan Hawke's not around, so clearly he was off making another movie, and he would just shoot these scenes of everyday life. And then after 12 years, he stopped, and he put them all together for a movie that allows you to watch a boy grow up on screen. It blew me away, and I couldn't really fully process why, and I was very deeply moved by it. And then I returned to it a couple times before I wrote about it, and it was one of those movies that I felt that as soon as it was over, I wanted to watch it again. Or actually, what I really wanted to do is I wanted to live inside the movie, maybe not living with Mason and his family, but I wanted to be in that world, and I could have watched 6 hours, maybe seven, and I kind of wonder when the movie finally does have its own special DVD, if it will have some sort of 6 hour, 7 hour, 8 hour cut. What the movie does is it kind of brings you deeply into the world, everyday world of a child, and actually it opens with a boy staring up at the sky. And he's looking at clouds in the sky, and it's a kind of lovely moment because I think it makes us all think about being a kid and looking at the world and how do we look at this world. And what you basically watch is you watch that child go from just looking at clouds in the world to living in that world and having to navigate that world and having a girlfriend and listening to his parents fight and having relationships with his sister and moving from school to school. What's interesting about the movie, just intellectually, is that movies often, they do fudge time and space, and you'll watch, you know, a decade go by. Think of Gone with the Wind, which compresses a lot of time in 2.5 hours or so. And this movie is actually showing you something that you don't see, which is the passage of time. And so the movie itself becomes about time. And when you are thinking about time, you also think about your own life. And what you're watching is how quickly a child grows up. Then you think about how quickly your own life goes by. And so here's a filmmaker who for 12 years followed a little boy and then showed us the labor of that in a wonderful movie that is itself about time, but it also about life.
Manola Dargis. She's a chief film critic for the New York Times. Coming up, we'll revisit a conversation with one of the most famous film junkies of all time, Roger Ebert. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
We're talking about film today, and for years, the most famous and trusted movie critic in America was Roger Ebert. His thumbs up or thumbs down convinced a lot of us to see or skip a movie. Well, a few years before his death, Ebert sat down with Steve Paulson to reflect on his legendary and also prolific career.
I've written reviews that are fairly serious, reviews that are fairly frivolous, and the critics that I like, I read them most of all as essayists, without really wanting to know if I should see the movie or not, because in most cases I have seen the movie, so I don't need to know the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel like you got it wrong? You know, if you see the movie a year later, or you know, after you hear what other people have said about it, you realize you blew it?
That's the most common question that a movie critic gets after how many movies do you see in a week. Have you ever changed your mind on a movie? And I usually answer that question by saying, would that be wrong to do that? Or should one, having been a movie critic for 39 years, never have changed his mind ever? Obviously, over a period of time, the experiences in your life and the experiences you have at the movies allow you to bring something to a movie, let's say 20 years later or 10 years later, that you wouldn't bring or couldn't bring at the time you saw it in the first place. And so I'm sure that my opinions have broadened or deepened. So, yeah, one hopes to be able to grow and learn, sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would think one of the obvious occupational hazards of being a movie critic is you just have to see a lot of junk. You have to wade through a lot of mediocre movies. Does it ever get you down?
No, because I enjoy writing reviews of bad movies. Look at it this way. If you had to see a bad movie, it'd be 2 hours of your life that you would resent because you had lost them and wasted them. I'm paid to be there. I got in free. And I get to write a review about it, in which I get my revenge. As I was watching Deuce Bigalow, European Gigolo, I was not suffering, because with every additional awful moment that went past, I was busily taking notes for my review.
So the worse it is, the more license you have to rip it apart.
In a sense, yeah. Some movies, I think a crime that's worse than badness is boring. In print, I review most everything that I can. I do about 280 movie reviews a year.
280 movie reviews a year?
Yeah.
Almost one every day.
Well, I have 8 coming out next Friday. And I like to write a lot of movie reviews because I enjoy writing.
You must be very fast.
Well, you know, I'm fast, but I'm not that fast. It takes some time.
How long do you figure a typical review takes you to write?
Some reviews take typing speed. Others can take...
Typing speed?
Yeah. I've written reviews at typing speed. I've also written reviews that took couple of hours and then let them rest on the hard drive and go back at them tomorrow and look at them again. And
you're saying you can write some reviews that would 5 minutes or something like that?
Oh, no, typing speed would still be longer than 5 minutes, I'm sure.
Okay. Do you have any guilty pleasures about particular kinds of movies? I mean, movies that probably in some objective sense are not that great, but you just really like them.
You know, when I saw Basic Instinct 2 with Sharon Stone, I knew that it was a bad movie, and it is a bad movie. But I found myself extremely conflicted about it because it was not boring and it was often awful in extremely engaging ways. I think I said that the role could not be played well, but nobody could play it badly better than Sharon Stone. And I gave it 1.5 stars, and I kind of had a funny little footnote saying that I gave it 1.5 stars sort of like a cold shower to keep myself from giving it 4 stars. Well, in a review like that, what I'm trying to tell the reader is, look, it's bad. We all know it's bad. But of the bad movies that are out there, this one is probably going to entertain you more than most of the others. There's a certain gratitude you have for some kinds of movies that are awful in grandiose or ambitious ways instead of just simply awful through stupidity and lack of any attempt to do anything.
Mm-hmm. When I originally went to see Dumb and Dumber, the person I went to see it with, she was laughing throughout much of the movie, and then when it ended, she said, "That was a really stupid movie."
Yeah, you know,
and I sort of said, "How can you say it's bad if you were laughing during it?"
I think I gave it a negative review, something like 2.5 stars or 2 stars, and yet the scene where the blind boy realizes that his parakeet's head has been scotch taped onto the body, I'm still laughing now when I think about it, and maybe I should have given that movie a favorable review. another movie, There's Something About Mary. Mm-hmm. That movie has six of the biggest laughs I've ever had in a theater.
With the dogs.
And they are separated by just about nothing.
Yeah.
It's just dead space, enormous laugh. Dead space, enormous laugh. Now, a perfect comedy, like the original Mel Brooks producers, the whole movie is great. And you can't say that about There's Something About Mary. But then on the other hand, when you're laughing, you are really, really laughing. And that's, you know, humor cannot be faked.
So as a critic, what do you say about a movie?
I gave it a favorable review while saying that, you know, it's pretty dead in between the laughs. But maybe the dead spaces are just building up to the next laugh in a way, although they're not really very well handled. But the laughs are well handled. You know, it's rare enough to find a perfect movie.
Have there been any perfect movies?
Yeah, there have been some perfect movies. McCabe and Mrs. Miller is a perfect movie by Robert Altman. Mm-hmm. It's a perfect movie. There is nothing wrong with it. Everything is right about it. Every shot, every moment, everything in that movie. It's just a wonderful film. And I can think of some others. O Hazard Balthazar by Bresson, the story of a donkey, is a perfect film. 2001 is a perfect film.
Now, when you look back over the history of film criticism, who are the critics who stand out to you?
Well, the critic that was most important to me was Dwight MacDonald, who worked for Esquire in the 50s when I was in high school. And by reading his column, I became aware of what film criticism could be, or indeed that it existed. And it changed the way I looked at movies. Hmm. I think that like most people in downstate Illinois, and when I was 14 or 15, I just went to the movie and looked at it and left. And it was MacDonald's example that led me to the art theater in town to begin to see Fellini and Bergman and the British directors.
Hmm. So what about Dwight MacDonald? What about his criticism?
You see, it wasn't important to me what he said. It was important to me that he said it and how he said it. I liked his style. I liked the way he wrote. I liked his scorn. But it was through the example of MacDonald and other people who were writing in those kinds of magazines at that time, Norman Mailer, Gore Vidal, these people inspired me or taught me or pointed me toward first-person personal essays.
Right. Now, I think some people would say that there have been a few critics who actually changed the way we thought about movies. I mean, sort of who elevated the respect for certain kinds of movies that were just dismissed before.
Well, what happened in the 1960s was that film criticism as a profession and film critics as people became visible in popular culture for the first time. There's been some backsliding since then. Today, most of the coverage of movies in the mass media is simply promotional and celebrity-driven. Nothing amuses me more than these infotainment shows. We've got the first look at the trailer for The Matrix, you know. And then they interview the stars and they visit the set. But they never tell you what they think about the movie. They will tell you everything about the premiere and what people wore and who was there and how much the movie cost.
They don't want to bite the hand that
feeds them. But they will not say if they liked it or not, because what they are doing essentially is using their access to this material to put their shows together.
Is this a good time to be a movie critic right now?
Well, it's a good time every time you see a good movie. In my career, I've had a lot of moments when you go into a theater expecting nothing and come out having seen a great film. Oddly enough, Gene Siskel and I had just come back from vacation and walked in on Monday morning to a 10 o'clock movie called Fargo that we, neither one of us, knew anything about. And we didn't even know it was directed by the Coen brothers, and their credit isn't until the end, although you might have guessed that it was. And when you stumble upon a film like this from out of left field, it's such a great experience. When I saw Monster, I expected nothing. And I had no idea that was Charlize Theron, and I never did until the final credits. And what a great movie that was. A Monster's Ball, too, you know, which I didn't expect was going to be anywhere near that good. And I was blown away by that. Million Dollar Baby. Clint Eastwood made that movie with no advance publicity, no interviews on the set, no infotainment profiles, nothing. I received a call. They're going to screen Clint Eastwood's new film. It's called Million Dollar Baby. It's going to be at 10 o'clock on Monday. And I walked into it, and I walked out, and I knew that I had seen that year's Oscar winner. But I had no idea what to expect. I did not know it was a boxing movie.
I'm amazed that that's, I guess, I would have assumed that, someone in your position would kind of know all the buzz.
No, I try to avoid the buzz. You know, you can go online, and there are sites where you can actually read early drafts of the screenplay and hear all about fights on the set and whether the director's cut is going to make it through and what Harvey is doing, you know, to some poor director. And I'm not interested in that. I want to go in, sit down, and look at the movie. Afterwards, I might want to find out more about it, sure.
Roger Ebert died in April 2013. That was an excerpt from a longer conversation he had with Steve, and you can hear the full thing on our website at ttbook.org. What exactly is it that we love so much about the movies? Sometimes it's sheer escapism, the adrenaline rush of a thriller, the feel-good pleasure of a rom-com. But writer Madeline Sprengnether once had a more profound experience. Going to the movies set her on a journey of self-discovery and even helped her come to terms with the sudden death of her father, all thanks to one film.
That was Padre Panchali, which is a film made in the 1950s by Sajit Ray, the Indian director. It just completely took me off guard, and somewhere towards the end of it, I started to just break down sobbing in the movie theater, not really understanding what was happening. And I just kept on crying and crying in this completely overwhelming way. I think it was for lots of reasons. It's visually very powerful. It's about the death of a young girl and the mother's inability to mourn her death in the immediate context. The mother seems kind of just stunned. And it isn't until later in the film, when her husband, who's been away, returns home and he's brought a present for this daughter who has died, and he's completely unaware of what has happened, that the mother breaks down and starts to cry. But the way this happens in the film is that you hear a musical score. There's no realistic sound. You don't hear the sound of her sobbing. What you hear is this incredibly powerful sitar music. And I think it was the combination of the mother's delayed reaction and this very unusual way of portraying her grief, combined with the fact of the daughter's death, that seemed to kind of tap into a grief that I felt as well, but had so deeply buried that I really didn't have any day-to-day access to it. Movies do something that maybe other media don't do. For instance, when I'm reading by myself, I don't have those kinds of very powerful emotions that movies can stimulate. And I think some of it has to do with sitting in the dark for so long. You spend something like 2 hours and often longer in the dark with a lot of other people watching very big images on the screen. And I think it puts one into not a trance state and not a hypnotic state, but something that makes you more vulnerable and I think is closer to the dream state. And maybe it does even tap into those parts of our brains that invent images for us while we're sleeping. And I think when you're in that kind of more relaxed state, that you're able to experience parts of yourself, even though you're watching someone else's story, that maybe you don't normally think about.
Madeline Sprengnether is the author of Crying at the Movies, a film memoir. As Madeline points out, great music can make all the difference between a scene that temporarily entertains and one that sticks with you, even haunts you, years later. Perhaps no other director knew this more than the master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock. His iconic movies, Psycho, Vertigo, North by Northwest, set the bar for film music. Writer Jack Sullivan explores how Hitchcock used sound to shape everything from atmosphere and pacing to the storylines of his films. In his book, Hitchcock's Music.
Music is almost like a preternatural force in Hitchcock's films. It kind of hovers over the action, influencing it for good or ill. It's certainly not background. It's certainly not supposed to be unobtrusive. In The 39 Steps and The Lady Vanishes, for an example, the music is actually a secret code that allows the Allies to thwart the forces of fascism. So it can be a force in the actual storyline, or it can be a deeply psychological force. Hitchcock called it the psychological use of music, where music expresses the unspoken, which means that music can actually say things the characters can't say or don't even know.
So for a film director, Hitchcock had a very sophisticated understanding of music, but he had a collaborator in all of this. Some of his most memorable film scores were composed by a guy named Bernard Herrmann. What was their working relationship like?
Well, it went from ideal to very, very sour at the end, but for the most part, it was ideal. Both of them were so deeply simpatico that Hitchcock would actually invite Bernard Herrmann onto the set and consult with him even before scenes were shot, which is very unusual.
Now, who was Bernard Herrmann, and where did he come from? How did the two meet?
He was a composer, an American composer from Brooklyn. Unlike most of Hitchcock's composers were émigrés like himself. He was a symphonic composer and an opera composer as well as a film composer, and he wanted to be recognized as an important symphonic composer instead of a movie guy. But what happened was the scores for Vertigo and Psycho in particular became so iconic that ironically he became known mainly as a film composer, even though he does have important and very beautiful concert works. But people usually don't ever hear them.
So let's talk about a few of the classic Hitchcock-Herrmann collaborations. First of all, the 1958 film Vertigo, which a lot of people think is a really classic film score. What makes Vertigo so special?
Because it perfectly embodies what Vertigo is about, which is obsession. The minute Bernard Herrmann's main title begins, the Vertigo Prelude, it just grabs you by the throat, and it's this kind of circling, repetitive figure that really does sound like a very deep obsession, and it continues coursing through the film practically from beginning to end. It's the film that Hitchcock asked Herrmann for more music than he'd ever requested before, and it obviously meant something very deep to Herrmann because he wrote some of the most powerful music he'd ever written for any film. Hitchcock said in several instances, "We'll just have the camera and you," and there are long stretches of Vertigo that have no dialogue. All those wonderful scenes with Jimmy Stewart circling, looking for Madeline in his car, the so-called dressing scene at the end, where Hitchcock was able to return to what he called pure cinema, which is just image and sound without dialogue. And I think it's the one movie that's impossible to even imagine without its music.
Hmm. Didn't some people think that the music was actually too intense, that it kind of set the audiences up to expect something that was much more horrific than the movie actually was?
Well, I write in the book that my theory is that one reason Vertigo was a flop, and it was a flop, and now it's an iconic masterpiece, was simply that 50s audiences weren't used to, well, first of all, they weren't used to seeing Jimmy Stewart have a nervous breakdown on camera and be put in the lunatic asylum. They weren't used to that. But they weren't used to something that began with such a riveting musical scenario that it raised that kind of expectations and then kind of deepened into a very subtle psychodrama that in some sections is actually quite slow. But I think that's right. I think the music really sets you up for something that now people are perfectly happy to go with, but in the 50s it didn't quite come off.
Now, another famous Hitchcock-Herman collaboration is the 1960 shocker Psycho. And one of the unusual things about that score is that Herman used only stringed instruments. Why did he decide that, do you know?
Well, I'd like to say that he was just brilliant enough to want to invert all the usual cliches about strings connoting romance and lushness. But part of it was just budgetary. Hitchcock shot that film with his black and white television crew for Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and it was a project he did completely in secret. Nobody even knew. I mean, Janet Leigh told me that nobody knew what the project was about at all. Sort of like the movie, that everybody has a deadly secret. So Herman couldn't afford a large orchestra. So that was part of the reason, but he called it black and white music for a black and white film, Herman did, and I think it really does come off that way.
Now, at first, according to your book, Psycho almost didn't happen, and it was Herman's music that really kind of saved the film.
Yes, it was an unusual story, and it just shows how important Hitchcock's music was. Hitchcock, after an initial burst of enthusiasm for Psycho, became gradually more depressed by the film. He thought there was something missing, something that was flat, something that just didn't come off at all. And he told Herman that he was thinking about cutting it up and just putting it onto Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And what happened was Herman told Hitchcock, go away for your Christmas vacation. When you come back, we'll talk about it again. Because Herman really thought this was a brilliant film and that he was very shocked that Hitchcock even had the thought of doing this. So he composed the shower cue in secret against Hitchcock's wishes. Hitchcock wanted that scene to be silent. And so when Hitchcock came back, he sat him down and he played the version that was silent. And then he played the version with his music. And Hitchcock just looked at him and said, well, of course, my boy, that's what we'll do. And that really got him very animated again. And according to Joseph Stefano, who was the screenwriter for Psycho, Joe told me that he was watching the dailies as they came in, and he too thought the film was really not very good, that there was something lacking. And he said one day Hitchcock summoned him to a private screening with no one else there and played the version with the music because he wanted Joe to hear it, because Joe himself had been a composer before he was a screenwriter. And Joe told me the minute the music came on, he just fell out of his chair. And
he said, so did a lot of audience members later.
Right. And when they played it for the production people, they all fell out of their chairs. And then all of us, I remember being a little kid, I did as well.
Yeah, I remember not wanting to come out from under the chair.
Right. Exactly.
Eventually, the two of them stopped working together. What happened? Those two egos
That. John Williams, who was Hitchcock's last composer, told me that he thought it was like two matadors just butting up against each other. Very stubborn guys, both perfectionists, both very independent, and that worked very well for them for a long time. And then finally, it came to a head during Torn Curtain, which was a disaster in the making, which Hitchcock divined it would be from the very beginning, and he wanted Herman to do something that would help promote the movie. He was under pressure to produce something hip, something modern, and Herman turned in one of these bleak, modernistic, pounding scores for something like 11 flutes and 9 French horns. And it was not what Hitchcock wanted, and he fired him on the spot right after the Torn Curtain Prelude was played by the orchestra, right in front of all his colleagues, and humiliated him in public, and that they never spoke to each other after that.
Is there a particular scene? I mean, I know you've watched hundreds, and so this is maybe not a kind question to ask you, but is there a particular scene from one of his movies that just really jumps out as, say, just a signature Hitchcockian musical moment?
Well, one of the ones that jumps out to me, and it just sounds like a small thing, but the schoolyard scene in The Birds, when the only music you have are school children singing Rissledy Rossledy, this very kind of charmingly tedious and endless repetitive tune. And that's what Hitchcock called counterpoint, where the music does one thing and what's on the screen does something the opposite that sets up this amazing tension. That one jumps out at me as something that's very Hitchcockian and that only he would have conceived.
Jack Sullivan is the author of Hitchcock's Music. Coming up, we'll hear about Hollywood's stunt women. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI. Public Radio International. We're talking about film this hour, and it's no secret that Hollywood has a diversity problem. Take, for instance, the fact that women only hold about 1 in 6 leadership roles in the film industry. Women actors have complained for years about the limited roles available to them, and female stunt women, despite facing greater dangers, typically receive less pay than their male counterparts. In her documentary Double Dare, Amanda McKaylee follows 2 high-profile women stunt doubles, Jeannie Epper and Zoe Bell. And you might know Zoe's name from her work with Quentin Tarantino in films like Kill Bill and Death Proof. Well, McKaylee says women stunt doubles appear all the time in movies and not always where you'd expect.
Anytime you see an actress tripping over a vacuum cleaner, that's a stunt woman. If there's a prostitute getting thrown down a flight of stairs, which happens more than you would think. I've watched a lot of movies looking for stunts, and, you know, that's a stunt woman. So it's not just the big hero moments. There's a lot of little moments, a lot of victim moments that stunt women are always there for. And I think, you know, you talk to any stunt woman, and they'll say, oh, yeah, I've gone down the stairs in a little nighty or lingerie. And, you know, that was one of the things that became very apparent to me was that costuming was a big issue for these women in their jobs. I mean, you look at the roles in Hollywood movies, and usually women are scantily clad. So if you have a stunt woman doing a big stunt, she's usually getting hit by a car in a miniskirt or high heels or something like that, whereas her male counterpart gets to wear a 3-piece suit or you know, sweatpants and a baggy shirt, so he can hide pads under there.
When I was doing Wonder Woman, you couldn't wear any stunt padding at all. They did let us wear nylons. We got to wear supportos. Luckily, the second season we had flat boots. The first year we did not have flat boots. They made us boots that were like wedgy heels. I used to tape my ankles almost like a football player. We just put on what they give you and do it.
Now that's the voice of Jeannie Epper, and she's one of these 2 amazing stunt women you profile in your movie. Tell me something about Jeannie.
Yeah, Jeannie was the first woman that I met after I was pitched this idea, and I just fell in love with her. She was the president of the Stunt Women's Association. She is definitely sort of the grand dame of the stunt world, not just for women, but for men, too.
People constantly ask me, God, aren't you getting about ready to retire? You know, nobody else lives in my body. They don't know how I really feel. I feel great. And as long as I'm feeling good, why shouldn't I be out there working?
she was a double for Wonder Woman. She did all the stunts in Romancing the Stone for Kathleen Turner, that big stunt where she slides down the mudslide and swings across a ravine. And she's just done a million movies.
She's been doing stunts for something like 50 years, right?
Yeah, she's almost five decades. She started when she was just a little thing, you know, doubling. They used to use kids. I mean, they used to use midgets to double for kids. And so Jeannie was one of the first kids that they actually used to, you know, on horseback to double child actors.
How did she get into this in the first place?
Jeannie's dad was a very famous stuntman. He had doubled for Ronald Reagan and John Wayne and all kinds of guys in the Westerns. So she was born into it. I mean, her family was a stunt family. And, you know, Steven Spielberg says in Double Dare that they're the flying Walendas of film. And it's true. I mean, they're like a circus family, but they were in stunts. So she just was born into it.
Well, tell me something about how... What makes a stunt woman an incredibly good stunt woman? Like, what can Jeannie Eppard do?
You know, it's interesting. I think a lot of stunt people have different talents. Jeannie was never really fond of high work, for example. That wasn't one of her specialties, but she had to really learn how to do it for Wonder Woman because all those jumps where Wonder Woman jumps up onto these buildings, and now, of course, it looks sort of hackneyed in retrospect. But those were pretty high falls because actually what they did was run them backwards. So she would be standing on top of a building and stepping backwards off of a tall building and then landing in an airbag. So I think, you know, for Jeannie, she has a fearlessness that she's willing to learn something even if it's not her specialty.
So Jeannie's what, in her 60s now, right?
Yeah, she's
And she's still doing stunts?
Yep.
What does she do now?
Well, you know, I mean, there's not big jobs for her anymore. I mean, sometimes she'll get something like, you know, being a granny that's about to get hit by a car or something. So sometimes it's really sort of slapstick comedic stuff. Other times she'll be coming in to double an actress that she's been doing work with for a long time who just feels comfortable with her.
I've been doing stunts for almost 50 years.
Whoa, guys, be careful.
It's all I really know outside of being a mom and a grandma. Retirement's not for me.
And roll it!
Now, Zoe Bell is the other stunt woman you profiled, and she's, I guess, what you could call part of the new generation of stunt women just coming up. She started her career on the cult TV show Xena the Warrior Princess, and I want to play a little clip from the show.
Hercules! Excuse me, we're conducting business here.
Hercules, you got to go to Elysia.
What's wrong?
Invaders, led by a warrior called Darphus.
Darphus?
Can't be. He's dead.
By your hand, if you're Xena, he showed me a scar.
What scar?
A huge gaping hole right in the middle of his chest. He should have been dead.
Only the gods have the power to bring Darphus back from the dead. I can bet which one it is.
That means nothing to me. I'm still going to Elysia to stop Darphus. I won't fail this time.
That's a scene from Xena the Warrior Princess, one of the shows that Zoe was a stuntwoman on. What's Zoe like?
She's from New Zealand, and she's just sort of a rough and tumble girl who grew up on an island outside of Auckland. First of all, I mean, she's just, you know, she's just like a nature girl. I think she has an attitude, again, a sort of fearlessness that she can learn almost anything. But certainly her experience on Xena leaned towards martial arts and wire work. I mean, that is a big...
What's wire work?
Wire work is when you're wearing a harness and, you know, that a lot of the Crouching Tiger stuff or the sort of martial artsy stuff that you've seen and, you know, that's become more popular in American films in the last 5-10 years is wire work. So the flips and the kicks and everything is all aided by wires. They don't want you to know that. That's true. But yeah, so Xena, there was a lot of wire work in Xena and it takes a lot of gymnastic ability. Zoe's background was in gymnastics and martial arts. So she was, you know, from the age of, I don't know, 5 to 15, she probably was doing amateur but very serious gymnastics, and she ended up retiring and taking up martial arts. So that stuff really helped her with Xena.
Watching your film, the stunt women make it all look so easy. But there's one scene in your film where it really hit me, at least as a viewer, how terrifying a lot of this is, and that's the scene when Zoe, for the first time, does a high jump. Do you want to describe that?
Yeah, and I'm terrified of heights, so that was particularly... challenging for me. Zoe was going to do a high fall training with Jeannie when she first came to the United States. And, you know, they kept asking her, well, how high have you gone? She's like, I don't know. I don't know. I think I've, you know, done 20 or 30 feet. And 30 feet when you're standing on a high fall platform, which is about the size of a piece of bread, is pretty high. But I think the first fall that she did, they put her up to like 50 or 60 feet. And from up there, Zoe says, when you look down, your feet are bigger than everything that you're about to land on. You know, the thing you're going to land on looks like about the size of a postage stamp. You can tell Zoe's nervous. I mean, her heart was pounding, but she just pulled it off. And, you know, I think there's a lot of body awareness that she has that most of us don't have. So, of course, it looks easy.
I could do flips in a harness with my eyes closed and totally know where I am.
I'm tuning this way.
Oh, that way.
But when you start hitting any complications, you have to understand how the rigs work and what the angles mean. Because it looks easy, people assume it is easy.
It's not just about having the guts to do it, and by no means are these women daredevils. I mean, they're very sort of exacting and precise when they're thinking about how they're moving and landing. It's not like, whee! So even though it looks like that from us, it's actually, you know, it's a sort of a precise thing that they're doing up there.
What's the most amazing thing you saw any of these women do?
I think when she – that fire – the fire stunt where she gets lit, she's wearing a big red kimono and gets lit on fire – that impressed me. And it wasn't so much like, oh, my God, she's getting lit on fire. But it was, oh, my God, we've been here for 15 hours and she's been lit on fire 15 times. And just the repetitiveness of it and just the stamina that it takes to be in 10 layers of long johns all night being lit on fire and covered with goop and, you know, whatever they're putting her out with and whatever they're lighting her up with. She was just covered with all different kinds of fuels and, you know, flame retardants, and it was really hot, and, you know, it was a long day. So it wasn't so much, again, the sort of impressiveness of one particular stunt than just sort of the dedication that it takes to get a shot like that finished, you know, just do it, do it, do it.
Now, I thought one of the most riveting scenes in the movie is the part where Zoe gets to audition at Quentin Tarantino's private training center, and there are all these other women there who are working with coaches, and Tarantino's just off to the side, and he's watching everything, and you know that Zoe's career is at the make-or-break point. Will you tell us about that part?
That actually is my favorite part of the movie, is watching Zoe audition and just the tension, because she kind of screws it up. She kind of falls on her face over and over and over again doing these flips, and we're all like, oh my God, I don't know if she's going to get it. And she, you know, ends up getting the job and goes to Beijing, and we follow her there through Kill Bill. She proved in the audition that she was tough. You know, like I said, she lands on her face more than once. And I think Tarantino just was impressed by her gumption and just fell in love with her.
Amanda McKaylee is the director of the documentary Double Dare. That's it for this hour, but there's more in our podcast feed. To subscribe, look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcasting app. And while you're there, don't forget to leave a review. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our producers include Raymond Tangekar, Mark Rickers, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Until next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.